This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nearly all of America's blunders in war and peace these past few years stem from a few grand ideas about American power and how the world changed after the Cold War and 9/11, ideas that proved to be false. That's the premise of the new book, Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. It's about the misconceptions my guest Fred Kaplan says have guided American policy and led us into Iraq, and about the men who came up with those grand ideas. Kaplan writes a column of military analysis called War Stories for the online magazine Slate. His first book, The Wizards of Armageddon, was about the men who first developed America's nuclear weapons strategy. Kaplan reported from Washington, D.C. and Moscow for the Boston Globe and was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize for a Boston Globe magazine story on the U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms race. Fred Kaplan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Let's talk first about the grand ideas, the grand theories that you write about in the book. The first is that everything changed after September 11th.
Right.
What's the theory?
Well, the theory was that we'd never experienced anything like this, and therefore the entire world has changed. You don't need to look at history anymore. You know, if you think back all the times during the Bush administration when people would try to look at the lessons of history when it came to, say, dealing with insurgencies or dealing with, say, the North Korean government or negotiating with adversaries, the attitude was always, well, that's in the past. That's old Europe. That's old thinking. We're in a new era now. And it gave them leave to just dismiss every lesson of history that went against the kinds of policies that they were endorsing and advocating.
Now, this dovetailed with another thing that you describe as a grand theory, which is that America emerged from the Cold War as the sole superpower.
Right. This is the paradox that I think a lot of people didn't and still don't understand. You know, the Cold War, I mean, it was a time of horror and depravity, but it was also a system of international security. You know, the world was basically divided into two spheres, and if you were a member of one sphere or the other, you went along with your superpower, at least to some degree, sometimes even sacrificing your own national interests in exchange for the security that was provided, or in the case of the Eastern Bloc, the oppression that was foisted on you. When the Soviet Union disappeared, just imploded in 1991, the common enemy, the Western Alliance's common enemy, also disappeared. Suddenly, a lot of countries realized that they could go their own way, that they could follow their own interests, regardless of what Washington felt about the matter. The main thing, though, is that in the past, there was this Western coalition. And sometimes various countries departed from it, but that was the default mode of international relations in the West. Once the common enemy disappeared, the default coalition also disappeared. If the United States wanted to retain its preeminence, it would have to go seeking alliances and coalitions, issue by issue, point by point. Diplomacy became a harder thing and a more vital thing. The Bush people came into power thinking that they were all eminent, that the United States was now practically an omnipotent power, that we didn't need alliances, that in fact alliances just sort of got in the way. And so, you know, forget about the ABM Treaty, forget about the Kyoto Treaty. After September 11th, and I think one of the most moving moments in transatlantic history, the other nations of NATO got together and said, we want to invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's the article which says that if one country is attacked, the others come to their defense. This was designed for the United States to come to the defense of Europe in the event of a Soviet attack. And here we're now, the European allies, saying the United States is under attack and we want to come help you. And Bush just blew him off, said, no, don't worry about it. We don't need this. You know, there were NATO meetings planned, conferences where we would work out a common approach toward terrorism. This was going to revitalize the alliance, and the Bush administration used it as a vehicle for rallying support for the Iraq War.
Okay, so let's just sum up some of the grand ideas you've mentioned so far. One, the world changed after September 11th. Two, the United States emerged from the Cold War as the only superpower, which leads to three, the United States could go it alone and didn't really need alliances anymore. And this connects to another grand idea that you discuss in your book, Daydream Believers, and that is that there is an ongoing revolution in military affairs. What is that revolution?
The idea is that we now have technology that substitutes for mass. If you have weapons that can be targeted to particular targets with extreme accuracy, if you have computers and surveillance systems that can get a complete picture of the battlefield, you can defeat armies with a very small force. And so you don't need large armies. You don't need allies going into military interventions with you. It can all be done with, from the air. Some people thought you didn't need armies at all. It could all be done with these wonder weapons fired from the air.
And so wars could be short and swift.
Short, swift, light. The whole idea of this, some of these weapons were designed at a time to overwhelm growing Soviet strength. After the Soviet Union disappeared, it was recognized, well, maybe this can be used as a tool to preserve American preeminence around the world. And the idea, the reason why Donald Rumsfeld, for example, wanted to go in to Iraq with a very light force. Remember, his generals were telling him you need 300,000 soldiers. He was saying, he pared it down. It was really a question that applied not just to Iraq. He wanted the Iraq War to be seen as a demonstration of American power, that even after the end of the Cold War, with a much smaller army, with no allies behind it, the United States could still work its will, could still change regimes that we don't like, practically with one hand tied behind our backs. And it was the revolution in military affairs that would allow us to do this.
And this was an idea that was also tested in 91 in the Gulf War.
Well, it started in the Gulf War. You know, the smart bombs, as they called them, were still a very small percentage. You know, of all the bombs that were dropped in the 91 war, only 9% of them were smart bombs. And a lot of them weren't that smart. They were still guided by lasers, and lasers could get diffracted by moisture and smoke and fog and dust. Now they had, though, by the time Afghanistan happened, they had these new kinds of weapons that were guided by GPS satellites. So all you had to have was the longitude and the latitude, and it would land right on the spot. And Afghanistan was sort of the turning point. You know, that there were times when these weapons would just come right in on their targets. Donald Rumsfeld took that as a redemption of transformation. Before Afghanistan went in, the Army was estimating that we would need to send two armored divisions in through Pakistan to overthrow the Taliban. Well, it turned out we did it with a handful of special ops forces and the smart bombs. So this had a significant effect when it came to Iraq planning. When the Army came in and said, okay, we're going to need 300,000 troops to defeat Iraq and to occupy it afterwards, Rumsfeld was thinking, well, you are way off on Afghanistan, and I have no reason to think that you're not still way off on Iraq. There was one thing, though. He forgot something about Afghanistan. You know, the Northern Alliance, with the help of U.S. support, was able to overthrow the Taliban government quite easily. But what he didn't realize was that, and now, of course, as we know, that the Taliban and al-Qaeda kept fighting. The war was not over. He made the mistake that many people who have forgotten their Clausewitz make, and that is that, you know, war is politics by other means, and the war is not over until you've accomplished the political objectives. It's one thing to destroy targets or even win battles. It's another thing to win a war. And you know, people say that both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, they won the war but lost the peace. I don't view it that way. They didn't even win the war. They forgot what the objective of the war was.
Well, Rumsfeld has been out for a while. So where does this theory of a revolution in military affairs stand now? Does Robert Gates believe in that? Do military commanders, current military commanders, believe in that?
Well, I think there's a more realistic appreciation of its limits. I mean, I think Rumsfeld was right and the generals were wrong in terms of how many troops you need to simply defeat an army and overthrow a government. But what is now being appreciated is that's really the start of things. unless you just want to leave the society in shambles, you have to impose order afterwards, or you have to create a situation where order can be imposed afterwards. And that's led to this renewed appreciation for the techniques of counterinsurgency, which is basically involving having a lot of troops, well-trained troops on the ground for a long, long time.
One of the technologies that was part of this idea of a revolution in military affairs was a missile defense, an impermeable defense that would prevent enemy missiles from penetrating the United States. In the Reagan era, that was the Star Wars technology. Mm-hmm. How hard has President Bush tried to keep the idea of missile defense alive?
Well, you know, it's funny. When he first came into power, that was his number one priority. He'd said this all through the campaign, that his number one priority was to junk the anti-ballistic missile treaty and to get a missile defense system going. This was another case, and maybe the most profound case, of the people coming into power not being familiar with history. If they'd been familiar with the history of missile defense, they would have seen that this story went back, I mean, not just to Reagan. It goes back to the mid-50s. I mean, it's a noble quest. It's a legitimate aim. But for technological reasons that have not changed and are not likely to change, this has just proven to be impossible. And it happens each time. About every decade, a president comes in saying, wow, this is really some new promising technology. Let's get rid of this nuclear danger. And then they start to work on it and they realize, oh, it has obstacles that are really insuperable. And the interesting thing is, for all the emphasis that Bush put on missile defense when he first came into power, by 2004, he's hardly said a word about missile defense ever since. Even though some interceptors have actually been deployed, he doesn't say anything about it, even though we continue to spend about $12 billion a year on it. You know, it's a great corporate boon. It's a technology boon. People still have hope in it, and therefore we spend, in the current budget, which Bush just released this week, he's asking for $12.5 billion, which is way more than for any single weapon system.
While we're talking about the perceived revolution in military technology, let me ask you about President Bush's new budget. He's proposing increasing military spending to its highest level since World War II, a $515.4 billion budget just for the military, and that doesn't include spending on the war in Iraq or the cost of nuclear weapons. And this is apparently 30% higher than when President Bush took office.
Yeah, if you add it all up, if you add in the cost of the nuclear weapons, the supplementals for the war, it really comes to about $713 billion.
What's it going toward? Like, what insights can you give us into the budget?
Well, the funny thing about the budget is that if you took somebody who fell asleep 20 years ago and woke him up now, and, you know, when the Cold War was still going on, and woke him up now and showed him the military budget, he wouldn't be surprised by anything. This is a budget that, again, except for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is dominated by aircraft carriers, submarines, fighter jets, missile defense. For all the talk about transformation, good or bad or indifferent, the budget is one thing that has not been transformed at all.
Does that mean that they don't believe in the revolution anymore, or that they're just funding all the old weapon systems anyways?
Well, you know, a lot of the generals and admirals who really run the permanent Army, Air Force, and Navy never got off on this stuff to begin with. They saw it as an attack on their mainstream systems. You know, when you talk about we want to build an army that is light, that is easily deployable, rapidly deployable, then you're talking about an army that doesn't have heavy tanks. And that's still the mainstay of the mainstream army. So they've stuck it out. They've survived in terms of what we're buying, what we're spending money on. And although this is changing a fair amount, but still what the soldiers and crewmen and so forth, airmen, are being trained on, it's still very much a military geared up to fight the Cold War.
My guest is Fred Kaplan. His new book is called Daydream Believers: How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fred Kaplan. His new book is called Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. And we've talked about some of the grand ideas that you write about in your book. There's a blurb on the back of your book from Tom Ricks, the Washington Post military correspondent who wrote the book about the post-invasion of Iraq called Fiasco. And he writes in this blurb that the story is told by an author who knows where the secrets are kept, and also that the most powerful and dangerous weapon in Washington, D.C. is a new idea. How do you think that fits into what you're trying to do, the idea of a new idea being a powerful and dangerous weapon in Washington?
Yeah. New ideas, if it's an idea with potency, it shakes things up. I mean, when Rumsfeld put out these ideas, some of which were very interesting and some of which were complete nonsense, but he did it deliberately to shake things up. Bureaucracies are made of power centers. World politics is made up of power centers. And the last part of my book goes into this. The idea that President Bush tried to put out there, especially starting with his second inaugural address in 2004, was this idea that the centerpiece of United States foreign policy will be toppling tyrannies and making the world democratic. You know, the freedom agenda. And this, to me, was maybe the most disastrous idea that the United States has put out in the last several years. I mean, the idea, of course, is a beautiful idea. People should be free. But he had an interesting conception. He said, I believe that freedom is a gift from God. Now, the assumption of that, if you take that idea seriously and not just as a nice little bromide, and I think that he does take it seriously, it's that freedom is the default mode of humanity. That, you know, if you blow up the manhole cover that is a tyranny, freedom will gush forth like a geyser. The implication of that is that you don't have to do anything to make it gush forth. You just knock off the bad guy and the rest happens automatically.
Give us an example of what you mean about toppling the bad guy isn't good enough. You have to work to have freedom.
Well, for example, the elections in Iraq. President Bush seemed to think that once you held elections, that showed that democracy was in action. And you remember the first elections in Iraq. I mean, they truly were inspiring activities. You know, these shots of the women coming out of the voting booths with their purple-stained thumbs. I mean, this was incredibly moving. But it didn't mean the beginning of democracy. As it turned out, all the Shiites voted for religious Shiite parties. The Sunnis voted for Sunni parties. And the Kurds, you know, voted in a referendum to secede from the government. Those elections, in fact, politicized social divisions that had gone back decades and even centuries. So just because you have an election, that doesn't mean that everybody has decided to settle down. You need to have democratic institutions which are able to mediate differences and settle disputes in ways that don't inspire rancorous violence. And that is what these places don't have. And this was what was just not understood as being a necessary precondition for true democracy.
Now, you say that the next president has to rebuild alliances. How difficult do you think that would be to do?
Well, it's actually going to be a lot harder than people who say they favor building up alliances think it is, I think. It can't be done just by piecemeal. You know, the other countries of the world have now had a taste of going out on their own, pursuing their own interests, quite apart from any consideration for how it affects Washington, how it affects international politics, but as somebody else sees it. China has risen. You know, you have India as a factor. And so alliances can't just be something that you pay lip service to. There's actually going to have to be compromises. In other words, if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama are the next president and the world rejoices, as I think they will, but you can't just go pay them a call, say, okay, it's the year 2000 again. It's the year 1990 again. We're going to be setting the policies just like we always did, but don't worry, we're going to be consulting. You can tell us what you think about it. No, it's not going to be like that anymore. We have different interests. I mean, sometimes they coincide, sometimes they converge, but on some things they differ. And if we want to create coalitions for whatever purpose, if we want to create alliances, they have to be truly common alliances. And on some things, we are going to have to compromise. The United States is going to be in a position that we've never been in. In all the years that we were an actor on the global stage, you know, since World War II, an explicit, active, persistent actor, we have always been the ones in charge. I'm not suggesting that we are in decline. I mean, the United States is still the only country with truly global reach politically, economically, and militarily. However, that's not the basis of power. You translate these raw materials into influence, into creating scenarios, into setting up agendas. And we are not the only powers in the world right now. And it's going to be very hard to create some of these alliances. It's going to be very frustrating. However, the alternative is increasing isolation and persistent defeat. If the America is not to be a declining power, then we are going to have to make compromises and make our way in a world that we don't really control everything in. And that is going to be very difficult.
Fred Kaplan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Fred Kaplan is the author of the new book, Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. He also writes the War Stories column for the online magazine Slate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The actor Bryan Cranston is best known as Hal, the childlike father on Malcolm in the Middle, but you might also recognize him as Jerry's dentist on Seinfeld, as agent Stan Grossman in Little Miss Sunshine, or as a guy with a severe headache problem on The X-Files. This year, Bryan Cranston got his first dramatic series lead in Breaking Bad, which was created by Vince Gilligan and presents its third episode Sunday night on AMC. This drama series has lots of funny moments. Cranston stars as Walter White, a shy high school chemistry teacher who's not quite making ends meet, trying to provide for his teenage son who has cerebral palsy and his pregnant wife. When he learns he has inoperable lung cancer, something in him snaps, and he decides to provide for his family the best way he knows how. He teams up with a former student to make and sell crystal meth. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, talked with Cranston.
Bryan Cranston, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
I want to start with a clip from Breaking Bad, because people who haven't seen the show yet, this will give them a sense of what you're doing and how you're doing it. I'm fascinated by your acting as Walter White, because for most of the show, you say so little but convey so much. This is a scene from an upcoming episode where you're going to come downstairs and walk in on your wife, who's played by Anna Gunn from Deadwood, when she's on the phone making an appointment for you with a cancer specialist.
Yeah, any time on Friday is absolutely fine. Thank you so much for working us in. Can I just put that on a credit card? Great. Perfect. Okay, so we will see you at 10:45 on Friday morning. Thank you so much. Okay. Oh, yes. Honey, the best oncologist. I mean, not even just in New Mexico, but one of the top 10 in the entire nation. His name is Dr. Del Cavoli, and we see him on Friday. I mean, Marie really came through for us. She had her boss call and... Okay. This is good. From here on out, I mean, things are gonna...
What's that we're putting on a credit card?
It's just a deposit kind of thing.
How much of a deposit?
It's $5,000.
$5,000? Jesus. And what's that, just to start? I mean, just to tell me what I already know?
I have to be honest, Brian. When I heard the premise for this series, I didn't think I'd like the character or the show very much. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about crystal meth, we're talking about cancer. But you really pulled me in. I still wasn't sure when the hour was over what to think of this guy. And I'm wondering, is that the only script that you saw when you had to decide whether to accept the part or not?
Yes, the only thing I saw was the pilot script. And as an actor, you know if it starts to seep into your soul and you start daydreaming about the character and having nighttime dreams about the character, then it's becoming you, or you're becoming it, one way or the other. And when I had my first meeting with Vince a year and a half ago, I couldn't help but start saying exactly what I felt about him. This is, I think he should be a little pudgy. I think he should be pale. I think he should be colorless. I think his clothes should be this way. I think he should have this silly mustache that doesn't really convey anything except that it conveys impotence to me. It was unnecessary. And it sort of was a manifestation of what I thought his life was like at that time. Basically unnecessary, that he felt useless, invisible to the world, to society, even to himself.
A question about a very dramatic scene in an upcoming episode, which is where you're deciding or confronted with the decision of whether or not to undergo chemotherapy treatments. And your wife stages a sort of intervention and everyone's around and you take turns talking by holding a talking pillow, which gives you the right to speak. And it's a funny idea in a very dramatic scene. And you're the last to speak. And finally, you get the talking pillow. And I thought, this is the first time you've had the talking pillow in four or five episodes. And how hard a scene was that for you to do? Because you were quite strong in it.
The thing about an actor approaching a scene like that is you can't for a second think that what you're doing is funny. Because if you do, then there's a slight wink, wink, nod, nod to the audience. Oh, isn't this cute? We're using this talking pillow. And all of us just took this idea that this gave us the right to speak at that time and to speak uninterrupted. And it's very respectful of the audience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a laugh track to it. And if the audience finds that piece funny, as you did, David, then I think you can smile or laugh if that strikes you that way or not. And ultimately, that is just so juicy to play because there's a whole wide range of reactions that an audience can have at any particular time, and none is wrong.
We're talking to Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. Your resume fascinates me. You seem to have been in the 70s and 80s in one episode of almost everything.
Mm.
Not several episodes, just one. But, I mean, mm-hmm. great shows like Chicago Hope and L.A. Law and 30-something and Hill Street. And then you're in Walker, Texas Ranger, Touched by an Angel, Jake and the Fat Man, and Baywatch.
Mm-hmm. A wide range of good programs and crappy ones.
That's sort of my question. But I mean,
yeah.
Clearly a working
actor. Oh,
don't
be embarrassed.
But how – and your first job is like on Chips, bless your
uh-huh.
soul. So first of all, how do you get started on Chips? And then how do you balance this career?
Well, when an actor first starts out, you're looking to work, any work. You need money to pay your rent and money to pay for your 8x10 pictures and your resumes and your acting classes. So you need some film on yourself. And that's you're willing to take just about anything. And remember, in those days, in I started in 1979, there was no record, no permanent record for anyone to keep track of the stuff. So you would accept a terrible show because you needed the money. And I did a movie called Amazon Women from the Moon.
Well, that was John Landis. Wasn't that John Landis?
John Landis did it, but terrible film. But you don't care because you're not going to put it on your resume. It's like it comes and goes. But there's several things that I've done that I've removed from the resume, but now in this world of IMDb, you can't hide. There's
that's really
all
funny.
The schlock that I used to do is now coming back, and it's all right there. So it's a piece of humble pie.
See, I always thought. I mean, I know of writers and producers who have, say, taken MASH off of their resume because they don't want to seem older, which I think is
right.
a sin because it's such an incredibly good show. I never thought of just intentionally keeping something off just because it was bad and maybe nobody
Direct.
Will notice.
Yeah, yeah.
But what do you remember about Chips?
I remember I had this terrible Southern accent. I think I was talking like this. I was talking like a special needs person relative of Gomer Pyle or something. I'll tell you, I was talking like, you know. And it was an interesting experience. I had a wife on the show named Kathy Schauer, who was apparently, and I didn't really know it at the time, she was a very pretty woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Playboy playmate. And it was like, wow, Eric Estrada. That's all he had to find out. Playboy playmate. And, you know, he was after her like nobody's business. And it's like, you know, it's interesting because I heard nothing but bad things about Eric. Things saying, oh, he does this, he does this, he's, you know. And he was nice to me on the show, I must say.
Well, another bad TV show. I mean, I've been a TV critic since 75, so I can say this. Another bad show you were on, but it had a good result for you, was Airwolf. Wasn't that Jan Michael Vincent in a helicopter? Is that the one I'm thinking of, or am I confusing
that's
that?
Walking. Yeah, no, that's the one. Jan Michael Vincent on his descent into his personal hell, which was horrible. This guy was, you know, had so much promise, and he was late every day, and he had, you know, his drinking problem, his drug problem, and there was a scene where we're in a helicopter, and they're shooting what's called a poor man's process, which is a helicopter is not actually in the air, but if you shoot from a low angle up, all you see is sky behind you, and there's a couple grips in the back moving the rotor, and it looks like the whole thing is in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And there was our first AD would say, okay, roll sound. Sound speed, here we go, slate it, and Brian, and he would shake his fist to me. That would be my cue to wake up Jan.
Oh.
And to have, not to, seriously, to wake up Jan and have him, you know, act in the scene. And it was such a shame, and I was like, God, this is so horrible, especially for a beginning actor when I was pretty new there. And wanting more than anything to be able to be a part of the acting community and to have the gift that has eventually came to me to become a good working actor. And I don't take it lightly, and I don't have any expectations of what the business owes me. I have no sense of entitlement. I just work.
We're listening to actor Bryan Cranston talking with our TV critic David Bianculli. Cranston stars in the new AMC series Breaking Bad. They'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with Bryan Cranston, the star of the new AMC series Breaking Bad. Cranston also played the father in the family sitcom Malcolm in the Middle.
One thing that I find in common between your part of Hal in Malcolm in the Middle and your new part as Walter in Breaking Bad, and there isn't that much that they have in common, but it's as an actor, a total lack of vanity when it comes to attacking the characters as you see them. And I'd like to play the first scene from Malcolm in the Middle where we meet your character. You're the husband and you're down. The kids are at the breakfast table. They're trying to eat. You're nude reading a newspaper that's strategically open to cover things while you're reading it. And your wife, Jane Kaczmarek, is shaving your back hair with some hair trimmers.
Look at this. They're sending an unmanned probe to Venus and letting a bunch of schoolchildren name it. Well, that's gonna end badly.
These clippers are dull already. Honestly, Hal, you're like a monkey.
They do this every month. He has sensitive skin. The hair gets itchy under his clothes.
Yeah, it seems like such a shame to just dump this in the trash. Maybe birds would like to make nests with it, or I don't know, maybe you boys could use it for school projects. Arms up.
So that's what memories does that bring back to you? And is it true that you had to have for your first scene in a sitcom or the first scene, maybe they were shot out of sequence, but you had to have yak hair glued all over you to make that scene
work? I have nothing but fond memories of Malcolm in the Middle. It was a fantastic period of my life. Brilliantly written by Linwood Boomer. That was the first scene. The first scene I ever shot in the pilot was the scene where I'm naked in front of all these children. And the person who's in charge of kids, you know, in taking care of them from the Coogan Law, and they have all these rights, which is fantastic now, mm-hmm. Insisted that in between scenes, I stand behind this black curtain. So apparently, while we're shooting it, my nudity was okay and didn't hurt the retinas of their little eyes. But in between, I had to go stand behind this curtain. But yes, it's true. I was, except for a modesty patch, and believe me, it was very modest, I had nothing else on. It took three makeup artists 4 hours to apply yak hair to my body. And they said it was yak hair, and they told me why. Yak hair most resembles human hair, but it's longer. So they were able to use part of it for the glue and still have part of it that is unmatted and standing out. But that meant I couldn't sit down. So for the entire day that we're shooting this, I never sat down. And I had my arms out most of the time so everything wouldn't get matted. But when it came time to actually shaving this hair off my body, the glue would get stuck in the razor and it would start to pull my skin. So we had to have a casting call for hairy back people. And they brought in all kinds of people. It looked like a carpeteria store where there was Shag and there was Lopile and there was, you know, Berber. And they picked the body type that they felt was most like mine, which is very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And they had a body double, and it turned out to be one of our Teamster guys. Turned out to be one of the guys that we actually shaved through and did the close-up shot of the hair cutting through the razor cutting through the hair, rather.
We're talking with Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. One of the things I learned reading about you for this is that your parents were actors, Joe and Peggy Cranston. Would I know them from anything?
You wouldn't know my mom, and my dad might be hard to remember. I remember when my dad was, he had the real actor's life. His life was up and down and up and down. And I remember him mostly dying in everything that I saw him do, from whether he was a soldier on top of the roof in the day that – were the end of the world. I forget what the name of the movie was. The sci-fi movie with the large grasshoppers that took over the city. He was in that saying, Sector 8 is fine here. And we see him die, you know. Or else he was an infantry man, or he was, in the cavalry and he got shot with an arrow. He was always dying. Hey, Dad's dying tonight, you know, so we'd watch him. But he met my mother in the late 40s in an acting class in Hollywood, and they were all in the same class with Anne Bancroft and David Janssen at the time, and it was kind of a good time for them, and post-war and everything was kind of on the upswing, and they married and decided to have children, and that's when my mom decided, well, I'll either have a career or be a mother. And those were the choices for women in those days, and she always regretted that. She always wished that she had pursued both.
One last Breaking Bad question. Okay. Do you have friends or family members who have gone through the process of chemotherapy and cancer? And if so, what did that do to your acting approach?
Yes, I do. And in fact, recently my sister-in-law went through breast cancer. And would go with her to her chemotherapy sessions and her radiation sessions. And it's very traumatic. You can feel the energy. It's a palpable trepidation. And you wonder, is this now the beginning of the end of my life? And as positive as you want to remain, it's difficult. And I took that information with me, but when I weighed it against what my character Walter White was going through, it was almost a fair trade-off, because he was just living a life of existence before. And the irony to this is that ever since this death sentence of a lung cancer that is inoperable, he's been more alive and more awake than he has in the past 25 years. So he's, in an odd way, he's accepting it and willing to deal with that set of circumstances.
Bryan Cranston, it was a joy having you on Fresh Air. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Bryan Cranston stars in the new series Breaking Bad, which is shown Sunday nights on AMC. He spoke to Fresh Air's TV critic, David Bianculli. Director Ernst Lubitsch was famous for his sly sense of humor, which was called the Lubitsch touch. When he came to Hollywood in the 1920s from Berlin, the early films he worked on were musicals. These almost forgotten films have now been released on DVD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
How I would love 1 hour with you.
I'm thinking of the same thing as you.
Then why delay?
Just one reason.
What's the reason?
It's my wife.
Ernst Lubitsch's best films are the most sophisticated comedies made in Hollywood between 1929 and the early 1940s, even after the stultifying production code went into effect in 1934. Trouble in Paradise was about two jewel thieves who fall in love while picking each other's pockets. In The Shop Around the Corner, James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan are a couple of bickering clerks who don't know they are writing each other love letters. It's infinitely more delicate and humane than any of its remakes, like You've Got Mail. To Be or Not to Be, with Jack Benny as the leading Polish Hamlet, is the most daring political satire to appear during World War II. And there's Greta Garbo playing a Russian commissar who is seduced by Paris in Ninotchka, her first comedy. Garbo laughs, read the ads, and so did everyone else. But Lubitsch's very first American films were pre-code musicals, and they already had the Lubitsch touch. Airy trifles filled with naughty double entendres that were too charming and funny to be offensive. The stars were mainly Maurice Chevalier and the very young and glamorous Jeanette MacDonald, who was an expert comedienne before her famous syrupy screen partnership with tenor Nelson Eddy. These early Lubitsch films are operettas about mythical European kingdoms with high-born but down-at-the-heels ladies yearning for both money and romance, or married couples faced with extramarital temptation. In Monte Carlo, MacDonald abandons at the altar a ridiculous but wealthy fiancé and falls in love with a duke posing as her hairdresser. It's silly but delicious, and it has some very good songs. One Hour with You is a remake of a Lubitsch silent film called The Marriage Circle. In it, MacDonald's best friend is making a play for Chevalier, MacDonald's reluctant, though tempted, husband. But MacDonald thinks he's interested in someone else, so to keep him away from the imaginary other woman, she keeps throwing him together with her trusted friend. The smiling lieutenant has a more darkly emotional side that foreshadows Lubitsch's later, edgier films. Here, Chevalier, as a randy officer, meets a fresh-faced young violinist played by Claudette Colbert. Guess what happens after this bit of dialogue?
So, you play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Someday we may have a duet.
I love chamber music.
But when Chevalier, on duty, winks at Colbert, Miriam Hopkins, as a dowdy visiting princess, thinks he's flirting with her. An international scandal is avoided when Chevalier is forced to marry Hopkins, even though he's still in love with Colbert and continues to sleep with her. When Colbert and Hopkins finally meet, Colbert feels so sorry for Hopkins, she teaches her how to dress and undress in style, sadly relinquishing her own hold on Chevalier.
Jazz up your lingerie, just like a melody. There's music with every ribbon and a flowing rhythm. Wear lace in harmony, a silken symphony. It's music and just the right note for you. Color should be seen, let your step-ins have no dull or gray tones. Wear your crepe de chine with some pep in up to date. Hey, hey, tones, jazz up your lingerie, just like a melody. Be happy, choose snappy music to wear. Jazz up your teddy bear.
I wonder if I dare.
Jazz up.
I'll try to.
Jazz.
I'd like to.
Come on.
I mean to.
Wake up, try something new.
That's what I've got to do.
Wake up.
I'll show them.
Breathe.
I'll teach them.
Get hot.
I'll try. Tra-la-la-la-la.
Not so hot. It sounds like 1850.
Lubitsch's most dazzling musical, and the one with the best score, is The Merry Widow, also with MacDonald and Chevalier. That hasn't yet been released on DVD, though you can catch it every now and then on Turner Classic Movies. But if you enjoy ultra-sophisticated romantic fluff, skillful acting, deft writing, and buoyant direction, these earlier films are sheer pleasure.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and co-editor of the Library of America's new volume of Elizabeth Bishop's Poems, Prose, and Letters. He reviewed four early Ernst Lubitsch musicals just released on DVD.